Good evening, everyone. I'd like to convene the February 9th, 2016 meeting of the House Committee on Agriculture and Natural Resources. We have a fairly ambitious agenda this morning, and we're going to be working a number of bills first off so that we can get them on their way to other places. So with that, I'm going to open a work session on House Bill 4046. And Mr. Roper, if you could please give us a brief summary of what this bill is about.
Sure, Mr. Chair and members. This is our wildlife penalties bill. It would increase penalties for the unlawful taking or killing of certain wildlife species. We have three amendments for this bill. The dash ones are the mandatory minimums. The dash twos deal with incidental takes. And the dash three is the amendment that adds the gray wolf to the list of game mammals.
All right. Thank you very much. And if folks would just bear with me here for just a moment while I sort through all my stuff here. I don't know how I am so disorganized this morning, but folks, I am. So, all right.
No comment.
No comments. All right. Thank you, Vice Chair Krieger. All right. Committee members, I'm inclined to want to take each of these amendments individually, simply because some of you have discussed various issues with the different amendments with me. And with that, I'm just going to go in a numerical order, and I believe, Vice Chair Krieger, you wanted to tee something up on that.
Yes, Mr. Chair. Regarding the dash ones, I think we explained it quite well last week.
Okay.
Perhaps understanding a little bit about a third violation for a major game violation, and I want to give you just a scenario. Someone goes out at night and he kills a four-point buck, closed season, only takes the head back straps. On the way home, he drops by Barreto Manufacturing, 2 o'clock in the morning. That rototiller looks pretty good. It's worth $5,000, $6,000. He has the best rototillers in the world.
Where's the button?
He gets the thing into the truck. And away he goes, gets caught, gets prosecuted, doesn't go to jail on either one of the charges. 2 years later, same scenario, 2 o'clock in the morning, kills a deer, takes it home, goes by Barreto's. This time he decides he wants a ditch digger. So he takes that. Third time around, same thing, 5 years later, within the 10-year period, third time he's killed a deer in the middle of the night, only take parts of it. And he says, I wore that rototiller out, I better get another one. Guess what? So the question is, should the guy go to jail for 180 days for killing three deer and wasting them, parts of them? And is it just as bad for him to steal three pieces of machinery from someone? Everyone would say you steal three times from somebody who's trying to make a livelihood. Probably should go to jail for 6 months. So I don't think it's unreasonable.
Thank you very much. Representative Barreto, an opportunity to defend oneself here.
Yeah, that was quite a setup. I guess all I'm saying is a mandatory minimum term of incarceration for 180 days and a person shall be sentenced to. Would you show me where the third offense is in that, Wayne?
I'd have to go through this thing just a second, see if I can get it right. Have you got a copy of the actual amendment there, staff?
Yeah. I do, if you want it.
Section down, section 2 at the bottom, at the time of the conviction, the person is subject to a prohibition by the court of state under arrest or not for applying for obtaining a license or permit issued. It has to do with the third conviction, or that during the time if the license from those other violations he was suspended, then he would be able to incur the 180 days. And as I recall, that's what we meant it to be.
So it's in one of those ORSs there?
Yes.
992 or 415. I follow up, Mr. Chair.
Please.
Yeah, I do struggle with this. I mean, in thinking this through, I would rather see the fines doubled every time during a conviction, you know, rather than the sentencing, I guess, of 6 months in jail, incurring more costs to the state or to the county, and then also taking him away from any potential of working that off. And so that's just kind of I think there are other means of making that a lot tougher law than sending off to jail. So my feedback.
Vice Chair Krieger.
The first, second, or third would still be a misdemeanor, $6,250, 1 year maximum in jail, if that could be assigned as it is now. But it would be up to the discretion of the court prosecuting district attorney to make the determination if they're going to ask the court to compound things, and you couldn't compound them on a second violation that when he already had a violation before and a court of disposition, he can't put on top of it like 2 years in jail or $12,000. So you can't increase the fines beyond the limit of the misdemeanor.
Okay. Representative Whitsitt.
Yes. I have a question on the Dash 1 amendments. So a person shall be sentenced to a mandatory minimum if, number one, the person is convicted of a violation of the wildlife laws or any rule adopted pursuant to the wildlife laws. So does that mean any rule that is on the books regarding wildlife?
Any books of rules that are on there, the administrative rules, that are, and then they're put out by the Department of Fish and Wildlife, open and closed season, type of firearm, synopsis, hunting at night, all these type of things, or some of them are administrative rules, and some of them are actual statutes.
So that broadens it more than just the taking of a game animal, correct?
Okay. Even the rules regarding waste would be a good example of it.
The other thing I was wondering if this applies to a stacked sentencing, if, for example, somebody's shooting and they kill three birds at once, and then each one of those birds is a violation in at one time, then if they did something like that again, is that the mandatory minimum from
each one?
Yeah. Stacking all three of those as a individual takings.
Multiple violations within a single act normally are not prosecuted by the district attorney that way. That would be up to the district attorney to see how bad it was and how he viewed it or if he had a past history.
Mm-hmm.
So, Vice Chair Krieger, just to be clear, they would be separate violations with convictions in each of the separate violation before it would invoke the mandatory minimum?
I believe that's what we intended, yes.
Okay.
I also have had some conversations with Senator Provansky, and he's going to be taking a look at that particular section when it gets over there.
Okay, very good. Additional questions or comments? I am not seeing any. With that, I would be... I'd like to ask the committee if there is well, first of all, I'm going to recognize Vice Chair Krieger for adoption of the amendment. Okay, so it's the top part.
And a correction to something I said a minute ago, too. It wasn't specific with Senator Provansky. It was with his staff person.
Okay, very good.
I did leave him a note regarding the issue.
Thank you.
Chair, would I move to adopt the Dash 1 amendments dated 1/29/16?
Vice Chair Krieger moves to adopt the Dash 1 amendments dated January 29th, 2016, to House Bill 4046. House Bill 4046. Is there any discussion on this motion? Seeing none, is there any objection? I'm going to ask that the roll be called on this, please.
Representative Moretta?
No.
Representative Esquivel?
Aye.
Representative Frederick?
Yes.
Representative Gorsuch?
Yes.
Representative McEwen?
No.
Representative Whitsitt?
No.
Vice Chair Krieger?
Aye.
Vice Chair McLean?
Aye.
Chair Witt?
Aye. Having received the necessary majority, the amendment is adopted. Mr. Roper, remind us again the second amendment, please.
Second amendment.
So the dash two amendments to House Bill 4046 deal with the incidental taking or killing of wildlife that occurs unintentionally when engaged in an otherwise lawful activity.
And so, committee members, this would, we had a number of questions during testimony that if there was a legal act and there was an incidental take, there was questions whether or not someone would run afoul. This says that otherwise legal activity is a pass. So questions or comments on this amendment? I'm not seeing any. Again, Vice Chair Krieger.
Chair Witt, I move to adopt the dash two amendments dated 1/29/16.
Vice Chair Krieger moves to adopt the dash two amendments dated January 29, 2016 to House Bill 4046. Is there any discussion on his motion? Seeing none, is there any objection to his motion? It is adopted.
Mr. Chair?
Yes.
Does that mean if you get excited and shoot two turkeys at one shot, you're off the hook?
You have to shoot them first.
Man. Representative Frederick, we're fast this morning.
Whoa. Wow.
Very good. All right. Thank you, committee members, for that one. Now we will entertain the dash three again, Mr. Roper.
Mr. Chair, members, the dash three amendments to House Bill 4046 would add the gray wolf to the list of game mammals for which the commission may institute suit for the recovery of damages for an unlawful take.
Thank you. And again, you'll remember by virtue of the public testimony that that we received, we were reminded that we had a rather significant oversight here. I think in light of another bill that we will be discussing here momentarily, it adds a little balance to both sides of the equation. Any further discussion on this particular proposed amendment? Not seeing any. Vice Chair Krieger.
Chair, would I move to adopt the dash three amendments dated 2/2/16?
Thank you very much. Vice Chair Krieger moves the adoption of the dash three amendments to House Bill 4046. Discussion on his motion? Seeing none, is there objections to that motion? It is adopted. Thank you very much, committee members. Before we launch into adoption, then, of the entire bill, questions or discussion at this point? People feeling comfortable? Relatively so. Representative Barreto.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I think as far as the bill goes, the motive behind the bill against the illegal taking of game, I am completely for. And matter of fact, probably 90% of the bill I'm good with. The thing that I really wrestle with, though, is the black bear and the cougar part, the predation, or the predator part of this bill. And when we talked about increasing a lot of these fines, we talked about the value of the animal. For instance, a big horn sheep tag or an elk tag, you know, auctioned off at an auction. And you don't see that for bear and cougar. Matter of fact, when they quit hunting with hounds, the tags went down, I think, to $2, you know, a piece for those because they knew that the numbers would rise up. And now we have cougars over where we are that have become basically pests, and they come into the towns. They don't even know the count of them up in the Mount Emily unit. And bears, too, over in our area down on the southern coast have become a nuisance. And And so this part of the bill I wrestle with, and I brought this up to Representative Krieger on the when I first saw this bill. I said these animals should not even be in here at that rate at $7,500. The wolf I agree with, you know, because if you take the amount of money that the state has put into that plan and you divide it by the number of wolves you've got, those are expensive creatures out there. So that is my issue, one of the issues that I have with this. So I just wanted to get that on the record.
Thank you very much. I appreciate that. Anyone else? Representative Whitsitt?
Yes. Personally, I have a problem with a mandatory minimum sentence for a violation of any rule that is pursuant to the wildlife laws, that a clause that broad encompasses so much. And so I'm having a problem with the mandatory minimum sentencing. And, you know, I wonder what would happen if a person does something, kills a nest of gray squirrels. That's the taking of, you know, maybe eight of them at one time. We don't differentiate between babies or whatever. And so I have an issue with that, as well as the $5,000 for endangered birds when we have wind farms that are killing them wholesale throughout the United States and Oregon with no fine for killing a threatened and endangered bird. So.
Thank you. Anyone else? I'm going to recognize Vice Chair Krieger.
Chair Witt, I move House Bill 4046 as amended to the floor with a due pass recommendation.
Thank you. Vice Chair Krieger moves House Bill 4046 as amended to the floor with a due pass recommendation. Discussion on his motion. Seeing none, would the clerk please call the roll?
Representative Barreto?
No.
Representative Esquivel?
Aye.
Representative Frederick?
Yes.
Representative Gorsuch?
Yes.
Representative McEwen?
Yes.
Representative Whitsitt?
No.
Vice Chair Krieger?
Aye.
Vice Chair McClain?
Aye.
Chair Witt?
Aye. Having received the necessary majority, the motion passes and the bill is sent to the floor. Now, I need a carrier for this bill. Who would like to? Do we have a volunteer?
I'll do it.
Thank you, Vice Chair Krieger. Vice Chair Krieger will be the carrier on this bill, and I am going to close, excuse me, the work session on House Bill 4046. Thank you, committee members. Fair amount of work on one bill. And next, I'm going to open a work session on House Bill 4140. Again, Mr. Roper, could you remind us of this bill?
Mr. Chair and members, this is House Bill 4140, related to sky lanterns. It prohibits the release of sky lanterns into Oregon's airspace, and it authorizes certain employees of the state to issue citations.
Thank you very much. Any questions or discussion issues with this one, Representative Barreto?
Yeah, I was talking to Representative Gomberg the other day, and I was thinking if we vote against this, if he puts a string on it and sells it as a kite, if that makes it legal.
That's
it.
I very interesting. I had that very same thought myself. Representative Esquivel.
Yes, it's just unfortunate that we have to regulate not lack of common sense. I mean, mm-hmm. It's amazing to me how many of these bills we have.
Once again.
Remember when we did the tracer rounds during the summertime in the forest?
Yes.
I mean,
yes.
Wow.
Yeah. Any further discussion, questions, comments? With that, I am going to recognize Vice Chair Krieger.
Mr. Chair, I move House Bill 4140 to the floor with a due pass.
Thank you. Vice Chair Krieger moves House Bill 4140 to the floor with a due pass recommendation. Discussion on the motion? Seeing none, will the clerk please call the roll?
Representative Barreto?
Aye.
Representative Esquivel?
Aye.
Representative Frederick?
Yes.
Representative Gorsuch?
Yes.
Representative McEwen?
Aye.
Representative Whitsitt?
Aye.
Vice Chair Krieger?
Aye.
Vice Chair McClain?
Aye.
Chair Witt?
Aye. Again, having received the necessary majority, the motion passes. And I, committee members, I think it would be nice to have Representative Gomberg carry this to the floor. All right, Representative Gomberg, in his absence, is assigned the bill. I'm going to...
Make sure we ask him questions.
I'm going to close the work session on House Bill 4140 and open a work session on House Bill 4040. Mr. Roper.
Mr. Chair, members, House Bill 4040 would ratify and approve the decision by the Fish and Wildlife Commission to remove Canis lupus from the state list of threatened and endangered species. Would also prohibit delisting in the future unless certain conditions are met. We have a dash one amendment for this bill, which removes the part about delisting and would just ratify and would ratify the decision of the commission to remove Canis lupus.
Thank you very much. And committee members, more specific to that dash one amendment, the original bill would have called for a reduction in wolves on both the east and west side before that relisting could have taken place, making it virtually impossible, at least for the time being, for that to occur. The dash one amendment, I think, clears up that that irregularity and makes this, I think, in most people's eyes, a workable. any other discussion at this point? Vice Chair Krieger?
Mr. Chair, I'd like to move the dash one amendments into House Bill 4040.
Thank you very much. Vice Chair Krieger moves the adoption of the dash one amendments to House Bill 4040. Discussion on his motion? Seeing none, is there any objection? Motion is adopted. Dash one amendments are adopted. Thank you very much. Vice Chair Krieger again, please.
Chair, would I move House Bill 4040 as amended to the floor with a due pass recommendation?
Thank you. Vice Chair Krieger moves House Bill 4040 as amended to the floor with a due pass recommendation. Discussion on that motion. Yes, Representative Esquivel, please.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I don't know what has been mailed out, but there's been some, I've had some phone calls from people in my district that are under some kind of impression that just because we delist this wolf, that we're automatically going to slaughter him. Now, that is far from the case. I don't know. I think it was the Humane Society that put it out, and she may have been very confused at what she was talking about because she thought that the wolf was about the size of a dog. And I explained to her, no, they're a little larger than a dog. In fact, they eat dogs. But anyway, so I don't know what's going on out there, but there's been some kind of mail-outs that are not quite on target. So this doesn't mean that we're going to go out and hunt wolves to extinction again. This means that we're just delisting it and confirming what the commission has done with the agreement of all parties involved. This was something that was struck. This agreement was struck quite some time ago by all parties involved, and so now we have some people who want to change the agreement. So we're just verifying the agreement.
And Representative Esquivel, just so the record is clear, I think I received a copy of that same email, and it was not on behalf of an organization,
in my district.
Okay, then I did not receive that. But an individual not on behalf of the organization, correct?
No, this is from, she said from the Humane Society, the okay. U.S. Humane Society.
Okay, all right. Additional questions or comments? Representative Gorsuch, I almost overlooked you. I'm sorry.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. So I don't have a problem with any of this process, and I don't think we're going to go out and do terrible things to wolves. I think that the plan has functioned as it was intended, My only concern, and I've been talking to a few of our legal colleagues who worry about this too, and that is the question of the precedent that it sets for the legislature to come in and kind of get involved in these things. So just for that reason, I'm going to be a no.
Okay. Thank you very much. I appreciate the explanation, too. Thank you. Additional questions or comments? Seeing none, I'm going to recognize Vice Chair Krieger.
Mr. Chair, I move House Bill 4040 as amended to the floor with a due pass.
Thank you very much. Vice Chair Krieger moves House Bill 4040 as amended with a due pass recommendation to the floor. Any questions on his motion? Discussion on his motion? Seeing none, would the clerk please call the roll?
Representative Barreto?
Aye.
Representative Esquivel?
Aye.
Representative Frederick?
Yes.
Representative Gorsuch?
No.
Representative McEwen?
Aye.
Representative Whitson?
Aye.
Vice Chair Krieger?
Aye.
Vice Chair McClain?
Aye.
Chair Whitt?
Aye. Having received the necessary majority, the motion passes. And Representative Barreto, would you like to carry this bill, sir?
I would.
Thank you very much. I am going to close the work session on House Bill 4040. And before I do, committee members, this was not an easy one. I recognize that, and I thank each of you for the very good work that I think has come out of this committee on this topic. Thank you very much. Close that work session. With that, we're going to move into the public hearing portion of today's meeting, and I am going to open a public hearing on House Bill 4007. Mr. Roper, please.
Mr. Chair, members, House Bill 4007 would expand the definition of rangeland protection associations to include entities organized with the approval of a county governing body, and a county having 200,000 or more acres of rangeland outside of any forest protection district and not protected by an existing RPA.
Thank you very much. Representative Smith, welcome to our committee.
Thank you.
And thank you for your very good efforts in trying to protect this state and our natural resources and all of its citizens and wildlife from the horrors of wildfire and rangeland fires. This is a tremendous bill. Thank you for bringing it forward.
Thank you, Chair Whitt, and members of the committee. For the record, I'm Oregon State Representative Greg Smith. I had the distinct pleasure of representing Hermiston and Milton Freewater and Stanfield and Umatilla, Morrow County, Gillum County, Sherman County, and the very, very best parts of Wasco County in Dufour and Antelope. So hopefully today what we're going to bring forward to you is a little lighter in work than what you've accomplished in House Bill 4040, which, by the way, thank you for that work. It's greatly appreciated. And also, just very, very quickly, in the interest of transparency, colleagues, I want you to know I do economic development work in Eastern Oregon, and I do work with counties, but the legislation before you today, there's no financial gain in any way, but I do want to be transparent to you. So, colleagues, very quickly, House Bill 4007 is going to provide additional method for organizing for fire protection on non-federal rangelands. As we know, the last couple of years, there's been a lot of land that's been on fire. And so our folks back in Eastern Oregon are doing the very best they can to manage this issue. And they're trying to do it in cooperation and in partnership, both with the government and with local landowners. And so what this bill would do is provide another tool in the fighting of range fires. You should have a letter before you. If not, I can make sure you get a copy from the Department of Forestry. And I want to read just one little paragraph in there. It says, rural protection associations are highly valued partners in Oregon's complete and coordinated fire protection system. They're currently 20. They're all volunteer. And they operate in Eastern Oregon, providing protection to 4.6 million acres of private and publicly owned rangeland. Colleagues, what we're trying to do is enhance this this form of fighting fires, and we would ask for your support. And Mr. Chair, next to me is the Honorable Judge Perry from Wheeler County. And if it'd be appropriate, I would hope you'd hear from him today.
Thank you very, very much, Representative. Judge Perry, great to have you here. Thank you for your presence, and please.
Yeah, Chair Witt, representatives. I'm Patrick C. Perry, Wheeler County Judge. I'd just like to give you a little bit of the history behind this. Prior to 2014, Wheeler County faced several issues regarding wildfire suppression. Specifically, over 500,000 acres of land within Wheeler County consisted of unprotected areas. These are defined as lands which no agency or organization had the responsibility to respond and defend in case of wildfire. This issue has seriously plagued Wheeler County for over 20-plus years. Historically, the traditional response was to rely on disorganized pell-mell of agencies and local ranchers. The local ranchers would often respond with substandard and possibly dangerous equipment. Local agencies found themselves responding to protect areas to which they were receiving no fiscal support to do so. In 2012, the Sheriff's Office and the Wheeler County Office of Emergency Management was notified by all the municipal fire departments in our county and the state and federal agencies, ODF, BLM, and U.S. Forest Service. They could no longer fulfill what was basically an unfunded mandate in responding to unprotected lands in Wheeler County. In a nutshell, Wheeler County Sheriff's Department formed Wheeler County Fire and Rescue, which is just a volunteer made up of basically the same local ranchers business people in the business community that respond to these fires on unprotected lands through the Office of Emergency Management. The sheriff had about $10,000 in his budget that used to start this up with, and that was a year that we really had a real serious fire season in our county, and it was a monumental task. We had a Wheeler Point Fire Agency that wasn't a district, but it was originally set up as a structure protection for a small community of Winlock, and it went defunct. So we ended up inheriting a bunch of its old, wore-out equipment, and we went in the firefighting business on our unprotected lands, and it was very, very successful. But with that comes the obstacle of keeping it funded. Our major cost is our insurance costs, and the changes to this bill would allow us as a county to receive the same benefit as the other rangeland fire protection agencies, and that would be our insurance cost and workman's comp. So that's basically what we need to keep our head above water and to continue to provide this service at no cost to our constituency. Why aren't we districted? Well, we have the second highest tax rate in the state at $8.53 a thousand. We're up against compression, so if we formed an actual fire protection district, we would be taking from our school districts, our health district, our extension office. We wanted to do this at a no cost to our taxpayer quite frankly, it just wouldn't be right. It'd be better to have the lands unprotected than to put that burden on my taxpayers. But you wonder, well, the value of protecting fire or putting out fire on these unprotected lands. And that value is these fires are caught small and put out, and they don't go on to become big fires that cost the state millions of dollars to put out. If we can catch them on the unprotected lands and keep them small or put them out, it's a huge savings to the state as far as the potential for a lightning strike on unprotected lands to be a monster, basically. So with that, I guess I'll just let you ask questions of me if there's any questions.
Thank you very much. Committee members? Judge Perry, does this bill enable the ranchers to be able to pool their resources? So if Rancher A has a cat and somebody else possibly has a tanker or something like that, that they could coordinate their their equipment and their response to these fires?
Yeah, that's correct. Let any rancher, especially if it's affecting his lands, jump in and run a cat. But in the structure, in our structure, through our Office of Emergency Management in our own county, it allows us to have a little bit of control to maintain a safe standard so that our local, the volunteers that we have will receive, through the state forestry, they'll come out and they have in the past, they came out and provided training for our firefighters. Our firefighters learned the structure of fire command, which is very important when one of these fires become big and they still need our resources. The people know how the chain of fire command work, and it provides a we provide with our own agency, we state county agency, we provide a level of fitness. We not maybe to the same standard of the state with the pack test, where they have to pack a pack weighs so much for a mile in a certain amount of time, but it allows us to not put somebody out there on the fire that might not be fit enough to and create a medical emergency in that context. So, but the ability, we do have an old cat as well that we respond to. Uh-huh. We've responded with it for the last 2 years, and many ranchers will lowboy their equipment in and help out and catch these fires while they're small. And I think I don't know if you received this white paper from my sheriff, but in there I think it explains the savings to the structures that they protected and kept from burning up in the last season, and that amounted to a lot of money saved in our own assessable tax property, you know, our property assessment. So.
Thank you very much. And I understand, too, that it's not just ranch land that's being protected, but there's a considerable amount of wildlife habitat in Wheeler County that would enjoy the protection here as well.
That's correct.
Thank you very much. Representative Frederick.
Thank you, Chair Witt. Thank you, Judge Perry. Good to see you again. There is a cost associated with this, though.
Yes, there is.
And how much is that? Do you have a sense of that?
I was talking with the state forestry this morning, and on the high end, $5,000. On the low end, $3,000. That would be the cost to the state that provide us with the same thing they're providing to these other startup rangeland fire protection groups.
Okay, but there's a cost. I mean, I've got to say, I've gotten a chance to go and see a lot of the fires in the state. Unfortunately, we've had too many.
Yes.
But I've seen a lot of them. And the thing that really comes out is the incredible coordination that takes place within the community, whether it's a logging fire like the one down in Spruce Creek or something like that down there just outside of
Weed, California.
No, that was one. That was another one. But the thing is that people get together and they work on that. I'm just curious about how we reimburse the money for the fuel for the cats, for the other things, and that, I mean, there's a cost that's associated just directly with fighting the fire, not the administrative cost at the county, at the state. But I'm just curious about how we reimburse for that.
Well, I don't think you'd be reimbursing for that in particular. We've started up this as a to be able to give private nonprofit people that want to make a donation a tax deductible venue to be able to donate to us. So we've developed a little bit of a war chest that, you know, I think we're in the $30,000 range that. By putting out a mailer to all of our constituency of, you know, this is what we're doing. If you want to voluntarily donate to it, we'll give you a tax-deductible donation. And we started it up in that fashion. And then we responded to the Canyon Creek Fire that burned up in Grant County that burnt roughly close to 40 homes, I believe. And as part of that, They put us on the payroll for our equipment. We had an old tender and two military Humvees with tanks in them that were staffed, and we gathered a little bit of funds from that, and we put them funds with our in our war chest, and that's what we used to make the organization continue on our own level. But believe it or not, that $3,000 to $5,000 is kind of the deal breaker. It doesn't have sustainability. We don't have sustainability without the ability to pull in some of our basically administrative cost as far as being insured and providing a workman's comp for our volunteers.
I just remember this was outside Canyonville, not Canyon Creek, but the one that was outside. And they put together a road that I think was something on the order of 15 to 20 miles long to just stop the fire from moving on.
Right. And, but in a very short period of time.
And they had folks from various timber organizations, I mean timber companies and other groups that came in and did that in like a day and a half.
Yes.
It just strikes me that those are costs that we don't hear about. And from what I gather, they're taking that up by way of a community coming together to pay for.
That's correct, that. Representative Frederick. A lot of it is fuel that is just the people actually just pay for it themselves. They show up with their equipment. They don't ever ask for anybody to reimburse them. They just expect a hand when they have a fire for the community to come help them. So,
thank you very much.
Thank you. Appreciate that. Representative Gorsuch.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. It seems to me that the state should be able to come up with $5,000. We're getting a huge amount of help from a very small amount of money. Personally, I think we should even give them money for fuel, as Representative Frederick was talking about. And I think you're absolutely right. Stopping it when it's small is so much better than letting it get out of control. So I think whatever we can do, if 5,000 is all we can do, then that's a start. But I think it's an admirable program, and I think we can do more to help. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
So, Mr. Chair, as we were putting this legislation together, we went down and had a conversation with Ways and Means and the Legislative Fiscal Office and the Oregon Department of Forestry. The cost to the state of Oregon is negligible.
Yes. Yeah. With, as Representative Gorsuch just pointed out, absolutely tremendous gains
great
for the
return
state.
On investment.
Great returns.
Yes.
Representative Barreto.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Well, first of all, I think this is a great idea, and it sounds like a rural community fire department, basically. One of the concerns I have, and not with this, but with statewide, and Representative Smith and I, we represent a lot of small towns with their own rural fire departments, and these rural firefighters, we have put in for tax credits several times to help these people, but by state mandate, they have to have a certain amount of training, like 70 hours a year, that they don't get reimbursed for. And I would hope that by organizing this, that you wouldn't fall into that same category, because I think that is a burden on the small communities to try and find volunteer firefighters that can, one, put in the time just to go out on the fires, but two, to have that mandatory training every year.
So, Mr. Chair, I have a chair with you, and Representative Barreto, that's a great point. In this bill, it's very focused on one piece, but that's definitely something we should look at in the future.
Yeah. Representative Esquivel.
Just for curiosity, what is the population of Wheeler County?
1,430.
There you go.
Souls.
There's the answer right there.
I think we had a birth though.
I know you don't have Kimberly, but you're real close to Kimberly.
I think we lost one.
Oh. I was going to say, you're breaking even.
Additional questions or comments for this panel? Gentlemen, thank you very, very much for your testimony. And again, Representative, thank you for bringing this bill forward.
Thank you.
I'd like to call up now, please, Doug Graff and Doug Decker.
Good morning.
morning, gentlemen. Welcome.
Good morning.
Pleased to have your appearance and your testimony.
All right. Very good. Good morning, Chair Witt, members of the committee. For the record, my name is Doug Decker. I'm Oregon State Forester, Director of the Department of Forestry. I'm joined by Doug Graff, Chief of our Fire Protection Division for ODF. We're basically here before you today to, related to House Bill 4007, to recognize the important role that rangeland protection associations play in the overall fire protection system. The bill provides another method, an important method for providing, allowing other governing bodies to form rangeland protection associations under the umbrella of the authority that exists with the Board of Forestry, the existing authority. RPAs, as you've just heard, they function kind of like a volunteer fire department. Think about them that way, where ranching neighbors are helping ranching neighbors to fight fire. RPAs do form under the responsibility on kind of the statutory authority of the Board of Forestry, but ODF does not have direct fire protection jurisdiction in those areas. The RPA basically will submit, the way this works on an annual basis, the RPA submits an annual budget and a cooperative agreement to the board. The board looks at that, reviews that. We work closely with the submitting RPA. The cooperative agreement talks about how we're going to work together, and then the Board of Forestry approves that. And basically, our role at that point is helping the rangeland protection associations with training, with equipment for federal excess property, and as you just heard, providing important liability insurance, which averages about $5,000 a year. Right now, there are approximately 20 RPAs in Oregon. There are 800 members of those 20 RPAs. Collectively, they protect about 4.6 million acres. There is about 1 million acres of unprotected land that are currently outside of rangeland protection associations, as we just heard, including those in Wheeler County. It's interesting that the original kind of authorizing legislation for RPAs came about in 1963, and it was brought about by a legislator from Malheur County who recognized the need to do exactly what you just heard. And one of the things that we were experiencing was that fires were starting out in the rangeland, and they were burning into ODF protection at a cost and a loss as well. And so the bill from 1963 was formed. The Ironside was the first RPA. There was a couple of others that were formed during the 20th century, and all of them have really come in the last 15 years during the high fire years in the Southeast. So they are very important partners for us and the complete and coordinated system. I think their work is cut out for them. They are hardy, very knowledgeable, first strike folks. Providing another way for them to organize under that authority seems like a reasonable and rational approach. So in closing, I would just want to thank Judge Perry, and I would also like to thank Representative Smith for his careful, thoughtful handling of this bill as it's worked its way through. Doug and I would be glad to take any questions that you might have.
Representative Gorsuch.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I want to go back to something Representative Barreto was asking. What is your response to that issue of training and the cost of that in terms of no reimbursement?
Right. Chair Witt, Representative Gorsuch. So I think the comment was really around the training for structural, for rural fire district firefighters. We do have a rigorous set of training requirements in the wildland community that need to be maintained. The currency needs to be maintained. In our world, in the wildland fire world, not the rangeland fire world, that's part of our ongoing business that we budget for and plan for during the year. We're doing that right now as we get ready for the 2016 fire season. I'm not aware. Doug might be, and I know there's folks from the Fire Marshal's Office here in the room that may be able to speak to exactly how the cost gets carried in the rural fire districts. In our business, it's part of our business and part of our planning.
That's fair.
Yeah.
I would defer.
Yeah. So I believe Jim Walker's here, and he may be able to speak to that point.
Okay. Thank you,
Better
Mr.
than
Chair.
We can.
Thank you very much. Representative Esquivel.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Is it just my imagination, which it could be, that we have more fires today than we used to, and the severity of them is greater than they used to be? Because I grew up here in Oregon, and I don't remember fires like we've been having as of, say, the last 15 years.
Mr. Chair, Representative Esquivel, indeed, if you look at the last 5 years, we have had an increased intensity and frequency of fire owing to a number of factors, which would include the presence of drought, the increased buildup of flammable fuels. You know, the wild card that we always experience is lightning, and, you know, that's a hard one to predict, and it's interesting and I think important to note that lightning represents about 30% of our annual fire starts, and yet lightning causes about 80 to 85% of all of the costs and the losses from fire come from lightning. And there has been an uptick in the last 10 years. You're not mentioning that.
Representative Gorsuch?
Sorry to ask another question.
All right.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. In terms of the buildup of, I don't know what you want to call it, but the buildup of litter on the forest floor, are there any active programs that work on kind of removing some of that in the forested areas? I know that it's a problem certainly in urban areas, too, where things have been set aside, like Forest Park in Portland as an example. So I'm just kind of wondering about that. I know that the buildup of that on the forest floor is not a good thing.
Chair Witt, Representative Gorsuch, indeed, fuel reduction is a significant action that we're taking, that the federal government is taking, the Forest Service as well. We've, between the feds and the state, we've been able to attract $10+ million to Oregon to help us fund the reduction of fuel in forested areas. And basically we're talking about removing tops, doing some and branches and things that are left over after a harvest operation or in unhealthy stands. And that is making a significant difference. Last year we did a look with partners at about 450 individual units that had been treated. In other words, areas where fuel had been reduced and removed. And in 90% of those cases, we found that the reduction of fuel resulted in a significant difference in fire behavior. And, you know, the fire, instead of being of a high intensity or being up in the crowns, was right. We were able to keep it on the ground. So it definitely makes a difference. And we have an active program engaged on fuels reduction.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Thank you. Anything further? Gentlemen, appreciate your appearance, and thank you for all the assistance that you're providing our rangeland partners.
Our great partners.
Thank you. Is there anyone else in the public that would like to testify on House Bill 4007 at this point? Not seeing any, I'm going to close the public hearing on House Bill 4007, and Mr. Roper will get that one scheduled here for a work session very soon. With that, I'm going to open up a public hearing on House Bill 4060. And while I call up Representatives Wilson, Leininger, and Courtney Moran, would you please remind us what this bill is about, please?
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, House Bill 4060 updates and clarifies provisions related to regulation of industrial hemp. We also now have a -1 amendment with this bill that deals with standards and protocols for testing industrial hemp crops for THC concentrations.
And I assume that you'll be addressing the -1 amendments in your testimony as well.
We will.
Thank you very much. Welcome to our committee, and please determine among yourselves the order of your testimonies.
Very good, Chair Witt. Thank you. Chair Witt, members of the committee, for the record, Carl Wilson, House District 3. Well, thank you for scheduling this. I think at the end of the day, you're going to be happy you did. This is an interesting opportunity to talk about something that's ancient and something that we have an opportunity to bring back, and bring back in a way that will mean something for especially rural Oregon. But anyone who chooses to be a part of this. House Bill 4060 is a bill that is addressed by some very knowledgeable people. And on OLIS, you will notice a letter from Seth Crawford, Dr. Seth Crawford, Oregon State University. And also Oregonians for Food and Shelter and the Oregon Farm Bureau have a lot to say that's good about this bill today. And what this bill ultimately does is bring back the industrial hemp industry and bring it to Oregon in a way that is going to be extremely profitable, I trust, for all. One thing that I talk a lot about is Southwest Oregon and the great economic difficulties that we have there. And without timber, we really kind of have nothing. We've been hoping that tourists would come by. And in the good years, tourists do come by. But yet, something as indigenous as the forests, all pervasive, it's all around us. It used to feed us and clothe us and do all of those things, but it no longer does. And so we are looking for every opportunity that we can find that will make a difference in the lifestyle and living in southwestern Oregon. And I think the legalization of industrial hemp over time, and we've seen it begun to happen. You can see the chronology that is listed in Dr. Crawford's letter. It has really begun to show itself as a possibility for all of rural Oregon. It is a bill that's going to provide clarification. Those who have been involved in the process have not been clear on what they can do. The regulatory framework has been a bit messy. And it has just been very, very confusing, this entire industrial hemp world. So what we've attempted to do with the bill before you and the subsequent amendment is to add surety, add clarification, let those who know, let those who are going to be involved in this product know exactly what the rules are and what they can do. With me today, Representative Leininger. And also Courtney Moran is here today. Courtney is my technical helper on any questions that you may have. And so enough from me at the moment, and I'd be happy to surrender the microphone to Representative Leininger.
Thank you, Chair Witt, members of the committee. I'm Ann Leininger, State Representative for House District 38. And I am delighted to be here today in support of House Bill 4060. I think it's an important step in our ability to create good value-added processing and trade sector opportunities that benefit Oregon businesses and families, and at the same time expand the kinds of good products that we can grow in rural Oregon in a way that makes sense for our communities. You are probably aware that in Measure 91, hemp was expressly legalized to the extent there was any confusion about that prior, just as cannabis was legalized, adult use marijuana was legalized. And in the 2014 Farm Act, federally, there was an effort to make clear that industrial hemp is a product that we're trying to allow the reasonable cultivation, processing, and production of. So I think it's a really exciting opportunity. Having grown up really near Representative Esquivel and Representative Wilson in what is known as the Emerald Triangle part of Oregon, right, happens to be a very prime area for growing cannabis, but also hemp. And it has been hard hit by changes in the natural resource economy. And we all rightly are looking for opportunities to create good ways people can live off the land, make a living from the land around our state, including in that part of the state. I think it's noteworthy that according to the Hemp Industries Association, and Forbes magazine has a statistic that's somewhat similar, in 2013, the value of the legal hemp market was over $500 million. And as this, with the passage of the 2014 Farm Act and people's growing understanding that this is a good product for all kinds of uses, I think that the value of that sector is going to grow and grow, and we have an opportunity to be at the forefront of that. I think Representative Wilson's bill, which I was pleased to sign on to, does a great job of helping us incrementally step forward, clarify confusion about what's legal, what's not legal, make sure that producers can have certainty as they make investments, and that we can help ensure that hemp production goes forward in a way that is compatible with other uses that people want to make of the land. It's a great bill, and I think it's wonderful to be able to come here with my colleague. I've had a great time working with on the Cannabis Committee to support this other wonderful agricultural opportunity for Oregon. Thanks.
Chair Witt, if I might add something. Again, we're not talking about psychoactive substance here. We're not at all. And that will be reaffirmed, of course, by testing to make sure that growers are in compliance. But when we talk about this this product, industrial hemp, we talk about fiber. In fact, looking back in ancient history, many ropes and lines, of course, made of this substance. We're talking paper. We're talking fabric, clothing, seed oil. We're talking biofuel. Food supplements, we're talking medicinal use even. So it's really an amazing product. And so that's why I think we're so excited to talk about it today. It's as ancient as can be, but we have an opportunity to engage in a great rebirth here.
Thank you very much. Vice Chair McLean?
Well, when you're ready.
Okay. Thank you. Courtney?
Welcome. Chair Witt, members of the committee, thank you for having this hearing today. Representative Leininger, Representative Wilson, thank you for testifying on behalf of this bill. I am a cannabis attorney. I'm also a lobbyist for the Oregon Industrial Hemp Farmers Association. It's an association made up of the majority of the existing industrial hemp licensees and an overwhelming number of farmers interested in becoming registrants with the industrial hemp program this upcoming production season. As Representative Leininger and Representative Wilson have stated, that this bill is really about providing clarification for the Department of Agriculture and for the industrial hemp farmers so that there is clear regulations and oversight for the industrial hemp program, and that this bill will bring industrial hemp regulation in line with traditional agricultural regulation in Oregon. So there's four major parts to this bill. Number one is regarding cultivation flexibility. Currently, the Department of Justice has interpreted the existing statute to require farmers to direct seed an industrial hemp seed into a field. It is the only crop in Oregon that is required to be direct seeded into a field. So what we are advocating for in this bill is to allow farmers to use clones, cuttings, and transplants for their propagation methods and to use greenhouses and other agricultural buildings in addition to fields for their cultivation. This, you know, brings it more in line with traditional agriculture, allows farmers to farm the way traditional farmers do farm, and also promotes coexistence between all cannabis because farmers are able to verify their genetics and, you know, sex their plants before they're put outside in any sensitive areas. The second and third major provisions of this bill are in regards to testing. Currently, the Department of Agriculture will go out to a field, they conduct an inspection, they take a sample, they bring it back to their lab and do a test to ensure that the industrial hemp farmers are compliant with the THC concentration limit, which is currently 0.3%, which ensures that it is a non-psychoactive crop. And this current process is very cost prohibitive for the farmers. The inspection, the department is charging upwards of $95 an hour and $350 for the test. So this bill will open up the door for farmers to use the labs that have been accredited by the Oregon Health Authority and licensed by the OLCC to conduct the inspections, take a sample, and bring it back to these labs to conduct testing. This will enable farmers, you know, to have local labs conducting it. They will have quicker results, and it will not be cost prohibitive for the farmers. The third part of this bill, so the Dash 1 amendment does clarify this portion of the bill. And it provides clarity that the Oregon Department of Agriculture can work with the Oregon Health Authority to establish standards for accreditation of labs to actually conduct the testing and the inspections. And it also provides that if any crop is above 0.3, that the lab must notify ODA of the results so that the ODA can go out and do their own inspection and testing. After final review of the bill and this amendment, we are going to have just an additional clarifying amendment that any test results be reported to ODA so that they know that a crop was tested and that it either has passed and been confirmed that it is below the 0.3% THC, or if it has gone over, that ODA can then go out and conduct their own inspections and testing. The third provision of this bill also is regarding testing, and this is having testing for any industrial hemp products intended for human consumption. Now, Representative Whitsitt, I know that you have some concern about industrial hemp oils and intended for human consumption, and I just want to provide a clarification first that there are two types of industrial hemp oils. One is industrial hemp seed oil. It's where the seed is cold-pressed and oil is extracted from that. This is edible oil. You find it in any typical grocery store. The other type of oil is CBD oil. It is derived from the flower. And that can be done from a variety of different methods, typically used for therapeutic or dietary supplements. Now, we agree that we want every product that is going into the market to be safe. So to ensure that, we are advocating in this bill for mandatory testing for any product intended for human consumption. So this would bring the industrial hemp program somewhat in line with the marijuana testing and OHA standards for the testing that's being conducted in these private labs accredited by OHA and licensed by OLCC will be done to these industrial hemp products. So testing for molds, mildew, pesticides, solvent residues, THC and CBD levels, so that we know exactly what is in the product that is going into the marketplace. The fourth portion of this bill is changing it from a registration or changing from a licensing structure to a registration structure. Now, this is more in language than in effect. ODA will still have complete oversight over the industrial hemp program. They have a right to refuse to register an applicant. They have a right to deny renewal of a registration, and they also have right to revoke a registration. And this is compliant with the Agricultural Act of 2014, the 2014 Farm Bill, Section 7606B1B sub 2, and it states that sites used for growing or cultivating industrial hemp in a state be certified by and registered with the State Department of Agriculture, and that is what we would like, registrations with the State Department of Agriculture. And this really will bring industrial hemp more in line with traditional agriculture in Oregon. There is no other crop that is required to be licensed. You don't need a license for growing wheat or for corn or for potatoes. We shouldn't need a license for growing industrial hemp, but providing having the registration will give ODA complete oversight over the program. They'll know who is growing, where they're growing, what they're growing, and still be able to conduct this testing to ensure that there is no psychoactive crops being grown. Now, again, with final review with the Department of Agriculture, there are a few additional clarifications that we would like to add in another amendment, and we are submitting that to Mark Mayer shortly after this hearing this morning. The first amendment would be a clarification to Section 1.2b, and it's changing the language, any building used for agricultural purposes, to any building used for industrial hemp cultivation, just so that's very clear. The second amendment would be to Section 12.1D regarding civil penalties. We would remove that section just so that there is no overlap into pesticide regulation and water quality, and so that those maintain as they are and will, you know, still be require the farmers to be compliant with those other regulations. And the other change would be in the Dash 1 amendment to Section 9A sub 3. Right now it reads that only test results that are resulting in above 0.3% result would be reported to ODA. We want all results reported to ODA so they can verify that the crop is either passed or if it has tested above 0.3 that they can go out and do their own testing and inspection. And Representative Witt, if I may approach, I brought the committee a pressed industrial hemp leaf from this first Oregon harvest. It was harvested on September 24th from the Hemp for Victory Gardens in Kansas.
Please. So this is among the first of industrial hemp in the state of Oregon? Here you go, folks. This is economic development for the entire state.
There you go.
Thank you very much.
Thank you.
And with that, I'm going to recognize Vice Chair McLean.
Well, first of all, I really do support this bill, and it's one that I've been looking forward to getting to hear, because I think it's got some very important issues that we have to deal with when we're trying to really be fair, equitable with our crops that are grown in the state, and also safety. And the amendment on testing is particularly important to me. And as we have Representative Leininger here, I want to make sure that we're doing it for everything that's edible. And both the marijuana and the hemp, I think we have high standards for both. I think we've got to continue to be vigilant about making sure that those processes are working. And also, to Representative Wilson, I'll be shocked if I can buy a pair of hemp pants, because I haven't seen many of these folks that look like they're going toward fiber fabric or any of those types of things. They're going to oil. They're going to seeds. They're going to some of the lotions. But when you do get your, you know, that market going, let me know. But it's one of those things where we want to be creative, and I think this does that. I do have just one question, and it was about one of the amendments. And the amendment that you were discussing, where you're going to go to status quo on the elements of responsibility on both pesticide and water. And so I want to just make sure on the record that what you're saying is that the hemp growers will be doing the same as any other product that's being developed in the state of Oregon or grown in the state of Oregon, and will follow all status quo rules in that area.
Yes, absolutely. That's what we want the clarification for.
Thank you very much.
Additional, Representative Whitsitt.
Thank you. I have a couple of questions. I was wondering if every batch is sampled, or is it random, and what is the random statistic for how you choose when you're doing your testing?
Representative Witt, Chair Witt, excuse me, and members of the committee, the Department of Agriculture goes out and does a representative sample of the crop. They, if you need specific clarifications, they are here and they can provide that for you. They will go out and they just take samples throughout the field. They collect that into a 2-pound sample is what they're currently taking, and then they'll let that dry, take the sample, and then test that. So it is a representative sample of the entire crop that's being grown.
Okay. If I may follow up, I was thinking more of the oils. When you said that it doesn't, it's non-psychoactive or psychotropic, does not exceed 0.3 THC. So I'm questioning if they test every batch of oil that comes out that's going for human consumption in some, either topically or internally.
Chair Witt, members of the committee, currently they are not being tested. That's what we are changing in this bill, is to require mandatory testing. So any products that are going to be in the market will be tested.
My question is every batch.
That is our intent, yes.
Okay. And then I have a question, since I'm not really that familiar with it. Does hemp have an odor when it's grown like marijuana, so that people who are next door smell it?
Chair Witt, members of the committee, all cannabis does have the same smell. However, when you're growing marijuana, you're growing for pungent flowers. And typically when you're growing for industrial hemp, you are not. And even the industrial hemp fields that I have been in that are growing for CBD flowers does not have the same smells when you're growing for THC potent flowers. You can smell it if you go up to the plant and you're smelling it, but it's not like you walk into the field or you're walking into the room and you're going to smell the same smell that you're getting from marijuana. It's just not as pungent.
Okay, if I may continue with the list, because I haven't been on the committee, so I'm not familiar with all of these things. What percentage of your hemp growers are growing for oils versus rope or clothing or whatever?
Chair Witt, members of the committee, the farmers are growing for all variety of purposes. We are currently in the process of securing a decorticator and bringing that to Oregon. It's very expensive, and it will be one of the first ones in the United States and in North America. Once we have a decorticator, we will be able to open up our fiber processing. Some of the farmers are growing for seed to retain it for their future planting, as we've been having seed importation issues. Several of the other farmers are growing for CBD oil. And the benefit of growing hemp, even if you are growing for CBD oil, is that you can still use these stalks. So we can be using them to use construction materials and eventually for fiber and other applications.
So if I may follow up, so they're all for oil right now? All of these farms are being used for oil?
No, not all of them. Some of them are growing specifically for seed.
How many?
There were only nine that grew, farmers that grew this past year. Only five of them had viable crops. And I believe three of them grew for CBD.
Okay. Thank you.
Thank you very much. And for the record, that most recent exchange was between Representative Whitsitt and Courtney Moran. Let's see. Who did I have? Representative Esquivel.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. This industrial hemp that has grown, is it anything like the marijuana that's grown in the aspect that they have genetically engineered plants, because they have hybrid plants and they come on all different sizes and shapes on the medical marijuana part? Is this the same as that? Are they dabble in the GMO?
Chair Whit, Representative Esquivel, I wouldn't necessarily call hemp GMO. In fact, we are, the group that I work with, we are very concerned about organic farming, and that is our intent. And, you know, there may be crossbreeding to provide different selections. I mean, reality is that it was all industrial hemp at one time, and it has been crossbreeded out to have either low THC or high THC. So it's more of traditional breeding than genetic modifications.
Yeah, I believe they started about 8,000 years ago, 10,000 years ago,
yes,
with industrial hemp, and it's evolved into quite a crop in southern Oregon.
Well, yes, it has.
Additional questions or comments for this panel? I'm not seeing any. Thank you all very, very much.
Thank you.
Appreciate you bringing this this bill forward and your testimonies as well.
Chair Committee, thank you.
Thank you. And Courtney, thank you very much. They have to have you put a little note here of when we receive this.
On the back of it.
All right, great. That will be wonderful.
That's just cash crop.
That's exactly right. You have to declare it too, Representative. With that, I'd like to call forward, please, Jenny Dressler and Jerry Norton. Welcome to our committee.
Thank you. Thanks, Jerry.
Good morning to each of you.
Good morning.
Good morning, Representative Whit, and good morning.
Is that working?
I think
so.
Okay.
Okay. Yep. Good morning, Representative Whit and members of the committee. My name's Jerry Norton, and I'm a farmer here in Oregon. My background is industrial farming this year, so it was our first year out doing industrial hemp, so it was kind of a research and development year for us, but we had a great year. We believe we had the first sustainable crop in Oregon in over 100 years, so it was really exciting for us. I come from a background of grass seed farming. My family does. They've been doing grass seed farming in Oregon for over 60, 70 years, and so they're really progressive in that field. So we were really excited to be able to see some other opportunities for Oregon and for farming, and to be able to quad crop a product and see what it could actually do. We're right now, we grew 2.5 acres this year, and that was the requirement by the Oregon Department of Agriculture. So it was quite a chore just to make that happen, but we did make it happen. And we produced our crop this year. When we say we quad cropped it, we produced 4 different things with our crop. So we have the stalks, which we used for hempcrete. So you chop it up. It's pretty simple. It's not rocket science. You put it with lime and water, and you can create blocks that are similar to cinder blocks. Hmm. And they're fireproof, they're moldproof, they're non-toxic, and the plant grows 14 feet in about 70 days. So it's just like, it's the tree of life.
How
I mean, you can make, you can totally construct with this product like nothing else. In fact, we're having a class in about a week in Portland on how to build with it. So there's a lot of things that you can do with it. So we're using the stalks, we're using the seed for different things, such as just one of the things as decking material for, there's a company in southern Oregon that has a company, it's called Hemp Shield, so they use it for a decking material. It's a one coat decking materials, and instead of having to import all their product from Canada, they're hoping they can get the seed from Oregon farmers. So there's a lot of contracts that would be available to us to do with just take care of people within Oregon. So, and then we were also able to press the seed for standard seed oil, and then we also did some research and development with the CBDs and was able to press some cannabinoids out of the product. And, of course, that's under the 0.3% THC factor, so doesn't get you high. So we were able to do more research and development. So we're excited about what we're doing with the product that, and the way we're moving forward with it. The what we're looking at is our cultivation freedom. We grew in both greenhouses and directly seeded into the field. We did what we call Sia Green, so it wasn't. We just sowed the seed and it grew, and it's really there was no pesticides used, so it was totally eco-friendly in that respect. We were able to, it takes out all the broadleaf weeds that want to come up underneath it because it grows so fast. And but it wasn't until the end of September 2015 that DOJ clarified the original status, declaring hemp farmers must seed direct into the ground. We actually used our greenhouses too at the very beginning of the season, as traditional farmers do here in Oregon with all their agricultural crops, to be able to get a jump start on planting. And so we were able to do that because we actually planted in June, the end of June. We really believe that this bill needs to pass because farmers need to be able to cultivate industrial hemp and agricultural hemp buildings using seeds, clones, cuttings, transplants, etc. This also protects against cross-pollination. I did a cross-pollination project this year in conjunction with Oregon State, and Russ Carroll from Oregon State did testimony about our cross-pollination in Oregon, and we're using a 2.5-mile buffer zone for that cross-pollination. We were successful this year with that project. So it's a major concern for us that we don't cross-pollinate and do friendly farming, because we did so much work on getting 91 right, and so we got to protect both ends of it. So it's really important to us to make that happen. That's one of our major concerns, and we were able to do that this last year, and that's one of our major concerns this year that we'll stay steadfast on. Also, with the testing in the OHA accredited and the OLCC testing laboratories, this year the OD came out and they took a 2-pound test at our fields. It's really, the amount is really irrelevant because there's a lot of product out there, but the costs were really cost prohibitive. Standard testing that's accredited through the OLCC and the ODA right now is approximately in the neighborhood of $200. Our farm here in the Willamette Valley run about $900 to have them come out and test us, so it was a little on the expensive side. So we feel that the results came back in about 2 weeks at two, so it was, the time was a little bit, timing's important when you're doing testing on this, because as farmers, we're dealing with Mother Nature, and we've got to be able to get, when it's time to harvest, and we can't really wait 2 weeks for a test. So we'd like to be able, since there's going to be a number of accredited labs throughout the state of Oregon, they'll be positioned strategically to where other farmers throughout the state will be able to actually take their product to that lab, get it tested, and it'll be within the guidelines of OLCC and the ODA. So we believe that having that particular ability to do that will give us a great advantage on those other costs that's really prohibitive to what we're trying to accomplish, and makes it a little bit more of a burden on the farmers. But it's really important to us, I can't stress enough, that how we want to have our products tested in the same fashion as the marijuana products, so they're for human consumption, to make sure they're safe, just like any other agricultural product that we're using here in Oregon and selling in the marketplace. That's of utmost importance to us. The registration factor on our bill brings into fact that is more in line with traditional agriculture in Oregon. I don't have to get a license to grow grass seed, and I shouldn't need a license for industrial hemp cultivation. So having a registration still allows the ODA to have complete oversight over the industrial hemp program, and the ODA will know who is getting what and where. So It's just more of a traditional method, I think, that would work streamlined throughout the program in the state of Oregon that would make more sense. So I appreciate your time, Representative Witten, Chairman, and all the committee for your time. We've worked really hard this last summer to make this happen, and I really foresee that it could be a great crop for Oregon and the United States of America.
Thank you, Jerry. It sounds like you're trying to deal with this in a very responsible manner. Thank you so much. Good morning, Jenny.
Good morning. Chair Witt, members of the committee, my name is Jenny Dressler, and I represent the Oregon Farm Bureau. Oregon Farm Bureau is the state's largest general ag association, representing about 60,000 members across the state. I am really excited to be able to come up here and testify today, sitting next to Jerry, who is a new Farm Bureau member. We worked on the hemp issue in 2015 with the Oregon Industrial Hemp Farmers Association, newly formed a couple months ago, and really got to learn a lot about this crop and about some of the challenges that they had implementing the statute and their license. So we actually had a couple of sit-downs with the hemp farmers and asked for them if you could put together a program that would work for the way that you would like to grow and the flexibility that you need as a farmer, what would you put together? And they came forward with House Bill 4060, and it was a great collaborative process, and they worked a lot with the Department of Ag, with Oregon Farm Bureau, to try to get this right so that we could have a program that works in the future. So excited to sit up here with Jerry, and I know I've got Farm Bureau members across the state who are really eager to kind of enter into this new crop and see what opportunities there are with the industrial hemp. You've heard from great certified smart people this morning on what this bill is and what it does. We have come such a long way and through so many iterations of this bill. There are a couple of technical adjustments that probably need to be made before this bill moves out, and I'm not sure if they were alluded to. I came in a little late into the hearing. There's the civil penalty section. I think Farm Bureau is concerned that that might overreach into our pesticide program where we already have a schedule of penalties.
Good idea.
As well as the definition of hemp, we're worried that it doesn't allow for the varieties, all the different varieties that could potentially be grown in this state. So we're happy to help work with the hemp farmers, anybody on the committee, to get those little technical adjustments, and we'll be supporting this bill going forward. So, and our testimony is submitted for the record if you have any specific questions.
Thank you very much. Representative Witsit.
Thank you. I have a list again.
Please, and feel free to pursue your line of questions.
Okay, thank you. I was wondering what the profit margin per acre on industrial hemp is versus grass seed. You might be able to answer that. On a successful, you grew 2.5 acres, so you could probably compare that to your 2.5 acres of grass seed that you used to grow.
Yeah, there's really no, Representative Webb, Chairman, Committee, there's really not any, I mean, it's like here to here, because we're able to, you got to realize, first of all, that we were not able to grow thousands of acres. We're on a real small scale now, so it's growing, but on grass seed as opposed to this product, we'll be able to quad crop it, so it's like apples and oranges. There's really no comparison whatsoever. We don't have specifics on the numbers yet, but it will be like from hundreds of dollars to actually thousands of dollars per acre.
Okay. Next question I have is, is the crop destroyed if it doesn't meet the guidelines set forth by the ODA for, say, cross-pollination, pesticide? What happens when it doesn't meet these set guidelines, and who destroys it? Who pays for that? How does that happen?
What they call in Colorado, they call it hot seed, and anything over 0.3% would make it psychoactive, and that would qualify it for it to be destroyed.
And I can't speak to that, but the Department of Ag is the agency that's responsible for oversight of this crop, and I don't have direct experience. Maybe Jerry does.
There was some that was planted this year, from some of the other farmers, and the Ag Department came out, and it was over the 0.3%, so it did have to come down.
Okay, so I should probably ask the Department of Ag, who pays for that, how, mm-hmm. because they have to destroy an entire crop. If we start growing this on a large industrial basis, maybe looking at hundreds of acres, something doesn't meet. And this is, we test it after it's grown then. So you put all the effort into it, and then it may be destroyed at the end of that.
Actually, they come out, they came out to our farm, the Oregon Partial, they came out three times this year, Representative Witten, committee chair. So they came out to the farm three times and did three different tests. So as the hemp grows, they want to make sure that it stays with within the guidelines of the percentage to make sure that it's not psychoactive. So the whole idea is to make sure that the hemp itself is a strain that is under the 0.3%.
Okay, and I have one last one, sure. If I may. Thank you. Is there a natural predator of hemp? I know the red spider mite is a natural predator of marijuana, and I was wondering, it's controlled primarily by pesticides if you get an infestation of red spider mites. And so I was wondering, is there a natural predator pest of hemp?
The crop that we grew this year, the predator was the bee. We had so many bees on our field, and it was just a wonderful miracle. That's why I believe it. And they weren't predators; they were like they were happy to be there. So we didn't use it.
Or afraid of.
Hey, some might say they had a buzz, but anyways, go ahead.
Man.
Sorry about that.
It was just taking your
taking your job.
Here. Took my thunder.
There was literally thousands and thousands and thousands of bees in our field, and it was a great thing. So we don't use pesticides. So
thank you very much.
Thank you very much, Representative. Representative McEwen.
Thank you, Chair Witt. This just begged a question. Representative Witsit's conversation opened up a question for me. So can the THC level in the crop change over time? Why do you need to test it multiple times? Is that an indication that it can change as the crop grows?
If you take a crop to its to the very end, some crops have 90-day, it's a 90-day, or 105-day. Different crops have different times that they will, when you bring them up to harvest. So with our experience this last year, we grew for seeds because we needed to replenish our seed this next year. So we grew it out to the very end. It was a stable crop and a stable seed, so we stabilized it, and it was fell within the percentages to make it legal. So we were lucky that way, and it all worked out. But by the same token, some of the seed, I believe, can potentially, if you take it longer out, it will create more THC. So in other words, if you took a crop out in 70 days as opposed to 90 days, you possibly could have a less THC content and save that crop. So if you continually checked your crop and had the ability to check that, when it starts getting to the range of higher THC, then you could harvest and you would eliminate any losses for the farmers.
Please.
So what I'm hearing you say is multiple testings would be required as you approach that limit, then you'll know when it's time to harvest so that you stay below the 0.03.
That would be smart farming, yes.
Okay. And the cost of that testing is borne by the farmer or by the Department of Ag?
By the farmer. So I this year we paid $850 for our testing with the Oregon Department of Ag. And then, so the new proposal, of course, is we're having the testing done, and it's quite more cost-effective. It's about $100 to $150, but it has all the pesticide, mildew, everything, just like the other bill.
All right. Thank you for the clarification.
You're welcome.
And again, for the record, respondent to Representative McEwen's questions was Jerry Norton.
Thank you.
Additional questions or comments? I'm not seeing any. Thank you both very, very much. Appreciate your testimony.
Committee. Thank you.
Your information was very helpful. Thank you.
Thank you, sir.
And next, I'd like to call up, please, Peter Gendron and Greg Clinton, and I guess Matt Cyrus, too, please. And while they're coming up, before I forget, Courtney, if you would make absolutely sure to coordinate very closely with Mr. Roper on amendments so that we make sure everything's timely and we get this in within our very short time limits, okay? Thank you very much. Welcome, gentlemen. Good morning to each of you, and please decide who goes first.
Thank you, Chair Witt, members of the committee. For the record, my name is Peter Gendron. I'm from Sunny Valley, Oregon, for the last 20 years, about 3 hours south of you in Josephine County. I am actually here as the person known to the cannabis industry as Pioneer Pete, the Omnibudsman, with an office up on Capitol Street, just a minute away from the State House here. That does get a chuckle from people the first time they meet me, and I'll tell you really quickly why it is that I'm asking you to indulge me for just a few minutes this morning. I had the privilege last year of serving in an advisory capacity to the Measure 91 Committee. I also held a seat on the Oregon Liquor Control Commission's Licensing, Compliance, and Enforcement Committee. I've served on several cannabis-related boards in the state and also manage the Oregon Hemp Convention, which is the largest hemp-related and marijuana-related show in the state, where you'll see products, if you come up to the Expo Center, like the Hempcrete and Hemp Shield previously mentioned, on display, and people actively encouraging the development and soliciting the purchase and sale of those products. Most recently, I had the privilege of serving by appointment of Governor Brown on the committee on implementing Senate Bill 844, which was passed in 2015. Most directly, our mandates on that committee were to identify and overcome obstacles to establishing state-run gardens, both for cannabis and for cannabis ruderalis, the hemp that we're talking about, and for the cannabis sativa and indica varieties, the medical marijuana and now adult use marijuana side, to establish a garden, to establish recommendations for what is going to be most likely called the Oregon Cannabis Research Institute. You probably have not had the opportunity to see this yet. Our draft framework just came out yesterday afternoon. So this is where I'm coming from. I am here not only as a cannabis advocate generally, but to address some of the confusion, because honestly, I figured we were going to be talking exclusively about hemp, but the conversation seems to be coming back to the marijuana varieties. Now, for purposes of discussion, just to simplify it, sensimilla simply means seedless, and most of our sativas and indicas are grown sensimilla. They are not genetically engineered. They are bred. There are 2,000 hybridized varieties of roses, and there are 2,000 hybridized varieties of sensimilla indica and sativa strains. Those stay sensimilla as long as we don't pollinate them. On the hemp side, what is currently on the table, thanks to the Department of Justice ruling in September, is that only direct open seeding of a minimum of 2.5 acres is allowed, and that crop cannot be sensimilla unless you went out into the field and culled every single male. Cannabis is a dioecious plant, which just means it has two sexes. It has a male sex and a female sex. The growers down in southern Oregon, where I live, the Emerald Triangle, do seek to produce primarily sensimilla crops because that's where the flower value is in the market, is seedless flowers. Under the current set of rules, before 4060 passes, in order to produce a seedless flower, you would have to direct seed into the field and then go out into the field and eliminate every male one at a time as they showed their sex later in the season. Greenhouse production is not currently allowed. 4060 would allow that. And it would also allow what we call pre-flowering. Obviously, in order to maintain these strains, we have to have a certain amount of seed in the system. So we'll deliberately raise select males, pollinate plants using those select males. The primary difference between the ruderalis and the sativas and indicas is the 0.3% THC definition, which is a number, I should say, was made up arbitrarily by a bureaucrat over 45 years ago who has no background in science. We can at least all agree that at 0.3% THC, it is not a psychoactive plant. The property that we're looking for in the human consumption CBD oil from flowers, Sensimilla ruderalis, is CBD cannabidinol. That has a wide variety of human health benefits, including being an immune booster and an anti-inflammatory. We've done a lot of work with this with the 844 committee. Studying the science, we have just pages and pages of references. I mean, I think we have like 10 pages of appendices and references in our draft report that just came out yesterday. There is some science behind this. Oregon wants to do more studying. Some of those draft recommendations that came out of the 844 committee were made with the anticipation of the passage of this bill, because we would like to do co-committant studies on marijuana varieties that are traditionally high in THC and also on the varieties that are traditionally high in CBD. Under the current ag regimen, if a crop has in it over 0.3%, it does have to be destroyed, and that is on the responsibility of the farmer under the supervision of the Department of Agriculture. Some of the questions, like how much exactly is a seed crop going to be worth per acre, or how much is an oil crop going to be worth per acre, we don't have the numbers yet because we're not far enough into this process. There were two gardens last year that tested in at over 0.3% THC, and that is still undecided as to what is going to be done with that product. There is a very good chance that they are going to have to be destroyed. However, we now have technology that allows us to isolate the CBD, and in fact, we can take a crop that tests in at, say, 1% THC, extract only the CBD from the oil, and destroy the rest of the product. There's an issue right now with medical and with recreational and the way the supply streams are going to work. That's still being worked out. And it probably won't be finished this year, but that's being addressed in another bill right now. There's going to be another issue about bringing Sensimilla ruderalis into the supply stream for human consumption. So testing is going to be for something that's made for fiber, for industrial oils. For example, that testing is going to be done under the current testing regimen, making sure just that the crop is in its entirety is under 0.3%. When we're making an oil concentrate out of flowers, it's most likely going to go into a vape pen or into a muscle rub. That material is going to be tested a second time as a batch test to make sure that the final batch still meets the standards. That also has to be food safe, of course. Now, we really, in saying two types of oil, we're differentiating seed oil from flower oil, but there are really three types of oil because there are two types of oil that come from the seed oil. One of them is an industrial machine oil, and the other one is an oil for human consumption. The oil for human consumption from the hemp seed actually has the perfect balance of omega-3, 6, and 9 fatty acids that the human body in good health needs to live. You hear about fish oil or flax oil being high in one or high in the other, and that's great for somebody who's out of balance. But what do you do when you get back into balance? That's when you switch over to taking hemp oil as a supplement, because that's the only oil that has the perfect fatty acid balance for the human body that's ever been identified. That oil would also similarly be tested the same way as a flower oil that would be used for topical application or for oral inhalation or ingestion.
Peter, in the interest of allowing the other two panelists adequate testimony, if you could move to a wrap up, I'd appreciate it.
Sorry, this is going slightly differently than the direction I had originally intended, Chair Wett. I can't actually go on about this all day, but
I suspected. That's why I thought I best interrupt now.
Okay, so I'll open it up to questions. I do want to tell you, as a member of the Sensimilla growing community, and a medical marijuana program participant for the last 17 years, I see this opening up in different ways. We have bipartisan bicameral support from all over the state, from southwestern Oregon to northeastern Oregon. I see from somebody who's been involved with this for 17, 18 years now, from my perspective, I see land areas that have higher value, like southern Oregon, where we're already developing sensimilla crops, being great places to do small crops, greenhouse crops. The land value is higher, and the value of the material coming out of there is higher. However, there's not as much land available, and it's going to affect the nature of farming. Whereas out in Representative Barreto's district, for example, that's where we're going to have the large pivots that are creating the industrial oils and the fiber. It's more in line with the land value, and it's more in line with the type of production. And this is something where the people in the industry will figure it out pretty quickly. They have the economic incentive to do this right. Thank you very much.
Thank you very much. Welcome, gentlemen.
Chair Witt, committee. My name is Greg Clinton. I'm part owner of High Mountain Organics. We're currently a medical marijuana producer, and we're looking to get into hemp. We got cut off last year when we went to apply for our license to start growing hemp. We are now going to pursue that. We have a small farm in Scio and a small little bit of land on the Willamette River that we plan to lease in North Albany to produce hemp on an industrial scale. The importance for the bill for us, we want to get into more the genetic research and development so we can provide those farmers in northeastern or large-scale farmers with a stable, suitable seed for their environment. That's one of the biggest problems facing the industry right now is if everybody gets a seed from Colorado, Kentucky, throws it out, we're going to have a lot of cross-pollination issues and a lot of upset farmers. So we're hoping to cover that base and develop select cultivars for those environments as soon as we possibly can, which will take time. But enabling us to grow into greenhouses and to do propagation in greenhouses, we're going to be able to develop that a lot sooner. We're going to be able to have plants in the greenhouses year round so we can try and develop strains for those specific environments. So that's a huge part on my side, is to have the ability to grow in greenhouses. It just doesn't make any sense to not be able to grow any agricultural product in a greenhouse. It's more we can go on for days about it, but it's more controlled. You can filter the air coming in and out. You have better options and better results. So ongoing the testing and the OHA accreditation for the labs, we currently use specific labs. It would be nice for them to be able to take part in this side of the industry as well, for them to be, you know, move them. The labs we're familiar with, they're cheaper. We have a better price break with them than what's set. We didn't grow last year, so we don't know exactly the price structure for OHA or the ODA for testing industrial hemp fields. We know the labs that we used are accredited by OLCC, and their testing requirements go beyond OHA's current testing requirements. And also, it just makes sense to test anything that the human body is going to consume as far as pesticides go and other chemicals that farmers are currently placing in agricultural products. It's something that I believe we should be going away from. And my family and my daughter has many allergens that are just coming, we're becoming aware of, from sulfates and parabens and things of that nature that, we're not going to test to that extent. But at the same time, people do deserve the right to know what they're consuming. And registration and licensing, it's more of a convenience for large-scale farmers, people, old-school farmers that don't want to jump through a bunch of hoops to take on a new industry that they're already skeptical about. If we can make it convenient for them, they would be willing to jump on the bandwagon with us and produce hemp on a more industrial scale so that we can all use it for clothing and things of that nature. So that's pretty much the extent of it for me.
All right. Thanks very much. Welcome, Matt.
Hey, good morning, Chairman, Committee. Thanks for having us. A little bit of background. My name is Matt Cyrus. I'm from Sisters of Oregon.
Our family is a sixth-generation Oregon farm family. I'm also chairman of the Deschutes County Farm Bureau. We're very interested in the opportunity to potentially raise a new agricultural crop in Oregon. I've been following the possibilities of industrial hemp for the last 25 years, and it's nice that legislation and laws are now come around to where we can actually potentially raise a new cash crop. In the 30s, my family raised clover. It was the main cash crop in our area, and then transitioned into potatoes up until the 70s, at which point the competition from the northeastern Oregon kind of put us out of business and the efficiencies of transportation with regard to those crops. We tried mint roots. We've tried a lot of different cash crops over the years, trying to find something we can afford to raise in Central Oregon with our limited climate. Very intrigued with the possibilities of industrial hemp. The bill before you would loosen things up with regard to greenhouses and allow us to start crops earlier and be able to transplant back into the ground in such a manner that we can actually have the ability to get a crop up in the short growing season we have. So I'd certainly encourage you guys to support this and get this through along with the amendments they proposed, I think make a lot of sense. And we're certainly looking forward to, like I say, a new possibility of an agricultural crop that we might actually be able to make a profit on. Thanks.
Wonderful. Thank you very much, each of you. Questions for this panel? Representative Whitsitt.
Thank you. So, Matt, I have a question regarding the water usage to grow. They talk about growing four crops a season, I guess.
That would be in a greenhouse. For what we would be looking at, we would be looking at starting in a greenhouse just to get the starts and then transplant those into a field for one crop.
So could you compare it to potatoes or things you've grown in the past? It's quite leafy compared to the final product compared to, you know, potatoes underground. It seems like it might be close to clover, but your actual water usage for a crop of a big field crop like in northeastern Klamath or Bend area.
I'm still learning a lot about it right now. A lot of research. My understanding is that the hemp is a drought tolerant plant that actually uses less water than some of the others. Granted, it is a fairly lush crop. It likes a dry climate. And potatoes were very water and fertilizer intensive that actually took a lot out of the ground. And from what research I've done is that hemp is actually the opposite. It actually is good for the soil as opposed to one that leaches all the nutrients. So where in potatoes you're trying to grow a tuber, which are mostly water, it's my understanding that hemp actually is less water intensive.
So if I may follow up, so we must have several different varieties of hemp if we're growing it in the Willamette Valley versus eastern Oregon. You wouldn't have drought-resistant hemp over here then, right?
If I may, Chair Witt, Representative Whitsitt, the amount is not going to be a fixed amount. Part of the fact is that this is experimental. The other part of the fact is there are enough different cultivars that something that is grown in eastern Oregon as a primary fiber or industrial oil crop is not going to take as much water as something that's grown in western Oregon, say in the Willamette Valley. Either crop would be comparable substantially to what is grown in that area already. If you look at, say, wheat in eastern Oregon, it will consume less water than a wheat crop grown in the same area. If you look at something like grass seed or canola in the Willamette Valley, it will consume less water. How much less is going to be a function of breeding. I will tell you in any case that it uses far less water than a golf course.
Additional questions or comments? Seeing none, gentlemen, thank you very, very much for your testimony. I have one last person signed up, Anthony Taylor. Sir,
thank you.
You can do your testimony in 1 minute, we're about to gavel this meeting closed.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. For the record, my name is Anthony Taylor. I'm a citizen of McMinnville with Representative Widener and Senator Boquist as my representatives here in the building. I really do support this bill, and I would encourage you folks to pass it through with due pass recommendation. I have some experience in fiber crop cultivation and harvesting and storage and what you do with it after you've got it out of the ground. In the early 90s, I was part of an OSU Extension Service pilot project to develop or try to reestablish flax in the state of Oregon. The the band of Oregon from like Dayton all the way across to Molalla is one of the best flax-producing areas in the world. And the one thing we did, several things we found out about this was, one, when it comes to harvesting fiber crops, there's very little equipment available. That has changed over the last few years with what's going on in Canada. And there was very little market for what we were producing, even though flax becomes linen and is used in that manner. This is one of the problems I foresee that I hope that the Oregon will address and work out, because when a paper mill says they need 60 ton of this product, this fiber a day, to produce the level they're producing at, that puts a big burden on the producers. It is a new industry. It is, as you folks were just talking, very drought resistant. In our early research, we found that hemp used only about a third of the water that crops like cotton, for instance, grown in California, using about a trillion gallons of water a year. Hemp is way less, has way less of an impact on that. So the infrastructure we really need to build, because it is a valuable crop. The hemp seed, of course, can be used for any number of things, including fuel. The fiber is strong and resilient, and I just would encourage the committee to pass this out, the due pass recommendation. Thank you.
Thank you very much. I appreciate your testimony. And with that, I'm going to close the public hearing on House Bill 4060. Thank you very much, committee members. I appreciate it. Remember, folks, you heard it here first, House Ag and Natural Resources.
A buzz on.
Folks, you heard it here first, House Ag and Natural Resources.
A buzz on.
Remember.